Hi, this is Daniela, one of the producers for Vermont Edition. An additional note before we start the show, for legal purposes, all licensed music from the following episode have been removed. We hope you still enjoy the conversation between Mitch Wortlieb and Joel Nashman. Thanks.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Mitch Wortlieb in for Michaela Lafrac. You know, there are some folks you hear on the radio who speak to you in a way that makes you feel like you've known them for years, even if that's not really the case. And sometimes listeners are lucky enough to get that feeling and the actual time with the person they tune in to hear. When it comes to Joel Nashman, the host of My Place, first on Vermont Public Radio and now Vermont Public, that relationship has spanned 40 years and continues to blossom every Saturday night. My Place is appointment listening for people who love music and the stories behind the tunes. Joel doesn't just play songs like a DJ would. He also digs into the connections between the music, the artists, and the times they reflect. It's like wandering through a musical museum every time you listen, and people have been doing so avidly for four decades now. So it felt like a good time to hear from the host himself, and I am thrilled to have Joel Nashman here in our Vermont Public Studios. Joel, welcome.
Well, thank you. It's my great pleasure to be here. Or as George Burns was saying in his twilight years, I'm happy to be anywhere at this point in my life.
Glad you brought up the great George Burns out of the gate. Listeners, this is your opportunity as well to speak with Joel Nashman. Have you been a longtime aficionado of My Place? Or maybe you've just discovered the show. People continue to do so. Do you have a favorite genre of music that you share with Joel? Or perhaps you've got a trivia question you'd like to try and stump him with? And by the way, good luck trying. You can send us an email to vermontedition@vermontpublic.org or give us a call at 800-639-2211. That number again is 800-639-2211. Well, Joel, I want to start by asking, first of all, why is the show actually called My Place?
Okay, well, when Vermont Public, or then Vermont Public Radio, first went on the air. First of all, we were located, yes, we are in the fort now, but it was a little white building in Fort Ethan Allen, walking distance from where we are right now, next to the Arroway Theater and that nice little church. Oh. That was the northern remote studio for Vermont Public Radio. And a number of local music programs originated there. They had a jazz program and a folk music program and an oldies program. You would see a fellow walk in with an armload of jazz records, and he'd play for an hour. And then David Field would bring in a couple of boxes of old 45s and play his show. And then another fellow would bring in a couple of albums of folk music, and that would be 3 hours of music. I believe it was either on a Friday or a Saturday night to start with. At any rate, the program director, who is still a very much important part of Vermont Public, Betty Smith, called me one time and said, the fellow, David, is not well enough to do the program this Saturday night. Would you step in? I stepped in. I did a number of programs subbing for David. David, at one point, was not well enough to continue with the program, so I became the interim host. And I think Betty could probably say this best, but after about 2 years of being the interim host.
After a while, they got to take away that label, right?
I guess this is becoming a habit and one that I enjoy.
So was the program always called My Place when David had it
first? Yeah, David called it My Place. That was his thing, and he did a wonderful job playing oldies, wonderful mix. You know, I had, you know, driveway moments listening to him play, and when I took it over, I was aware of being a big fan of a group called The Crystals. I knew that they had recorded a little-known song called My Place, and that has been adapted into my theme. And interestingly, I'm still very good friends with Lalla Brooks, the lead singer of The Crystals, who sings My Place every Saturday night for me. And there was a stretch down at the Eastern States Exposition in West Springfield, Mass., in which she was a week-long guest performing two shows a night. at the Eastern States Exposition. To make a long story short, she invited me up on stage, and I sang with her on eight shows.
What a thrill that must have been.
Absolutely, singing some of the great songs. And when I say the Crystals, Da-do-run-run, I met him on a Sunday, and my heart stood still. You know,
Da-do-run-run-run. Yeah, you
get
me singing
just right. This was number one records, you know.
Well, you know, before we get to the early parts of your radio career, I want to go back to the beginning of your actual life in music, and let's talk about, you know, where you grew up, because where you grew up and the songs you were hearing at the time really kind of molded who you are today, right?
Oh, absolutely. I grew up in the Bronx, and, you know, my mom was kind of an early helicopter pilot. She didn't want me to go out into the road and get run over by a car. I think if I obeyed her instructions, I still yet will have ever crossed a street by myself. And so, anyway, you know, ways of adapting to the fact that she never wanted me to go out and take chances and things, I just bought a lot of records and listened to them. And when this thing that Alan Freed labeled rock and roll came into being in the mid-1950s, I was hooked. I was absolutely hooked.
And a lot of the music back then in the Bronx, I'm imagining, and I'm actually thinking about a movie that, oh gosh, what was it called? It was A Bronx Tale, where the doo-wop on the corners and people just singing. That was what you were hearing, right?
That was really the truth. I really cannot carry a tune. That's probably why I, you know, play music on the radio. But these guys were singing on the corner. It was exactly like it was portrayed. And there's no greater music than the human voice. And these guys, regular kids, just would gather on the street corners to sing. Actually, more typically, they would go down into the well of the subway. And just going down maybe a half flight with the tile walls, you would get an absolute perfect reverberation. Think of the Kenny Vance song, Looking for an Echo, that you were always looking for that echo. It was quite remarkable. I'll tell you a quick story. There were a bunch of guys that would be singing in a pool hall. Of course, at age 10, I was too young to go into the pool hall, but I would just stay outside listening to these guys sing inside. Just remarkable. And I found out after a couple of years, several of them became members of the Mystics. Remember Hushabye, that song, Hushabye, Hushabye. And the Passions, Just to Be With You. These guys all became part of that doo-wop scene. But I remember them singing on the street corners and, you know, from inside that pool hall.
Incredible. You know, we do have some clips of some tunes, and I'm gonna be asking you a lot about, you know, older things, but I know already just from what you've told me, you've got these memories stored. What was the first record, Joel, that you can remember owning?
Probably Rock Around the Clock.
Okay.
And that was, well, the first one that I remember owning as a record was a 7-inch 78 RPM plastic record, yellow plastic with a small hole. And it was a kid's record. And I may have been, well, let's see. I did look it up a long time ago, and I think it was 1950 or 52. So I had to have been 6 or 7 years old. Mm. And it was called The Carrot Seed. It was just a kid's record.
Well, believe it or not, we actually have little bit of The Carrot Seed by Ruth Krauss,
the
name.
That's right.
Can we play that, James? Okay. I saw you nodding along to it. You remember that, yeah?
Yeah.
Does that bring you back?
Absolutely. I don't think I've heard it in 60 years, 70 years.
You know, it's not the most danceable tune or whatever. When you're 6 years old, though, you're going to be riveted.
But I tell you, what got me riveted is that they didn't want me to mess with my dad's equipment, so they got me this little kiddie, you know, a record player, you know, with a 2-pound tone arm, and I could put my records on that. And so I had a bunch of kiddie records. Of course, as we all know, in a couple of years, when I became a young teenager, and the 78 RPM records, which were so easy to break, the 10-inch ones, and, you know, cost a couple of bucks even back then, were replaced by the 7-inch 45 with the little hole, which a kid could buy, if you knew what store to go to, for 59 cents.
Mm.
Suddenly, music became, you know, available and buyable and affordable by young teenagers. And that's when the music on the radio changed. You know, you don't have to be, you know, a genius to say, hey, if the people that are buying records now are teenagers, let's make music for teenagers on the radio.
Absolutely. I'd like to play a bit of another song now. This is one you'll definitely know, and a lot of listeners will as well. Earth Angel by the Penguins.
Oh, boy.
And I want to, after we hear a little bit of it, hear about your relationship with this particular tune.
Joel,
That music is playing in heaven right now.
It's just beautiful. Who's the lead singer
Curtis
on that?
Curtis Williams singing with the Penguins. Interestingly, that was a record that was recorded in Los Angeles for a record company that was planning to overdub a whole bunch of music on that, you know, guitars and more piano. But that was just the basic demo recording of the song. However, the songwriter, which also was Curtis Williams, Dootsie Williams, I believe, and not related, who owned the record company, Duto Records, found out that a copy of the version we just heard was delivered to one of the popular Los Angeles DJs who did his afternoon show in the front window of a music store. And he was playing the undoctored version, the version we heard. Clearly, they would have ruined it had they overdubbed all kinds of music on that, because it is simply the magic of the human voice and harmony. Yeah,
I mean, you can hear it. It's just velvet, that Williams voice there. It's just wonderful. Let's go to the phones. We are speaking, by the way, with Joel Nagyman, the host of My Place. And if you'd like to join this conversation, do give us a call at 800-639-2211. We've got Harry on the line right now. Hi, Harry.
Hi, Mitch.
How you doing?
Joel, how are you?
Pretty good. Hi.
I'm doing well. I'm driving. I just wanted to call two reasons. First of all, the first song you mentioned, that Ruth Krauss, was the writer. Was she the same Ruth Krauss who went on to illustrate or write the book Harry the Dirty Dog? That's one question. We can look that up later. But the two things I wanted to ask Joel were, first of all, I adore your show.
Thanks.
Joel, you know this because I wrote you a letter and you responded in kind. We're both dog people, but I loved My Place so much. I could listen to it for 4 hours into the night. But my trivia question for Joel is, I think I should do it in a voice, maybe.
Please do, Harry.
We all know the famous Paul Simon song, 50 Ways to Lose Your Lover. But do you know the rudimentary arrangement Steve Gadd based his drum riff off of?
Ooh.
Second part of this question, Joel, is who was Steve Gadd's famous bass playing roommate at the Eastman School of Music, who later went on to play bass for Peter Gabriel and King Crimson?
Oh, my goodness. Oh, good. Well, you got me on that, I have to admit.
You know, by the way, this is Harry Bliss, the famous cartoonist.
Oh, my goodness,
I just wanted that.
Oh.
I want folks to know that. I didn't want to reveal that at first, Harry. I was going to let you do that. You know, Harry, I can only maybe do the second part of that question. We're not talking about Robert Fripp, are we?
He was the guitar player. The bass player was Tony Levin.
Oh, no.
Yeah,
oh, my
yeah.
Gosh.
I know the Tony name, Levin. but you did stump me.
And the rudiment is a 16-stroke roll. I urge everyone to go and look at Steve Gadd's breakdown of that particular drum riff. But we're getting away from you because you're the best, and I love you.
Well, and Harry, thank you very much for your gift, too. By the way, I have several of Harry's New Yorker covers on my wall right now, thanks to his kindness. And I admire your work so very much. I catch every time in 7 days and have your books as well. I am so flattered and so honored that you listen to the program. Thank you very much. I'm a great admirer of what you do.
We are very lucky here in Vermont to have so many folks who are, you know, you see these genres crossing, cartooning and music, and just a great love of the arts. And Harry, thank you so much for taking the time to take that call and be safe on the roads.
I was looking at some Paul Simon information. I'll be very quick on this one.
Sure.
You know, 50 Ways to Lose Your Lover, of course, that was one of his big hits. But then afterwards, Mother and Child Reunion.
Love that song.
Yeah, you know what the story is behind that?
No, tell me.
Well, it's a complicated story, but the Mother and Child Reunion is that after the family had experienced a tragedy, they lost a pet, they went out to a Chinese restaurant that they enjoyed going to, and the Mother and Child Reunion was an egg and chicken dish. where mother and child were reunited. Yeah.
You know, this makes me wonder, and I, you know, we're going to go to a break in a moment, but, you know, you do so much research into these tunes. How does that process work? Where, how do you do your research for all this stuff?
Okay, well, I just left in the car because I got here a little early. I'm reading a book, the autobiography of Sissy Houston, who is Whitney Houston's mother, and she had written her autobiography years ago before her daughter and her granddaughter tragically died. In which the book mostly is her coming to religion and her singing with the gospel group. But God bless her, and she just passed away. I had the wonderful pleasure of meeting her about 3 years ago. She in the back of the book, put a discography of every song that she sang backup on. And you would just would not believe it. All the hits of the Drifters, Brown Eyed Girl by Van Morrison, all yeah. those la-la-las. You hear the female voices. Sissy is backing her on that. She sang behind Elvis on Suspicious Minds. And anyway, so get ready 2 weeks from now, Sissy Houston, who... If you look at charted records, records that made the Hot 100, Sissy Houston, Whitney's mom, sang on more hit records than Whitney did.
That's incredible. Wow. We are speaking with Joel Nagemann, the host of My Place. We're going to be taking your phone calls. If you'd like to join this conversation, give us a ring at 800-639-2211. You can also send an email to vermontedition@vermontpublic.org. We're back with more of Joel Nagemann after this. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Mitch Wertlieb in for Michaela Lafrac, and today we are delighted to have Joel Nagemann in the studio with us. He is the host of My Place and is celebrating 40 years of doing My Place at Vermont Public. Joel, I want to dig in a little bit more to some of these early days and artists that really had an influence on you and that you loved. You had some actual superstar singers and bands growing up in your neighborhood, and I'm thinking mainly here of Dion and the Belmonts. Is it true that you would, you know, hear them harmonizing around your neighborhood?
Well, believe it or not, you know, they were the heroes of the neighborhood. I saw them many times, not out on the street, because by 1958, they had already had their first hit records, I Wonder Why, which is, I think, the consummate a doo-wop record, and I would go to whatever lounge they were performing in. But then the venues got larger and larger, and so they were movie theaters and places like that down in Manhattan, where I'd have to tell my mom I'm just going to the candy store at the end of the block, and then go hop on the train and go down.
That's a long trip to the candy store.
I know. She probably dialed everybody in the Bronx. Is my son there? But at any rate, I got to see them perform there. And over the years, I've been in touch with Dion many times. I visited him down in Florida, where he was living for many years. A bunch of years ago, the legislature acknowledged an anniversary that I had, and Dion had sent a very, very nice thing that was framed, pointing out all the many times that I had been promoting his records over the years, because he had gone through many different genres of music, his folk rock and everything, after the doo-wop and pop music records of the 1950s and early 60s, lesser known, but still part of the great career. It's hard when you become a superstar in one genre of music to move to another. I'm sure I don't have to tell you that.
Well, yeah, not me personally, but you're right. I mean, that could be something that could be difficult when you get pigeonholed in a way.
Right.
But when you're so good at something like Dion and the Belmonts was, and let's play a little bit of a tune that we've got here now. It's not the one that you mentioned, Joel, but you'll know this song very well. That's My Desire. Tell me about the influence of doo-wop at the time, because, you know, in a few years, the Beatles would come in, sort of that would change. How big was that sound?
Well, it was, you know, if everybody remembers, let's say, the first Beatles number one hit, no matter where you were, you remember that record. And it was a number one hit everywhere you happened to be in the country. But living in the Bronx, there were like very obscure doo-wop records that I would be like a number one on a local chart, and I would be convinced that it had been number one in the world, but probably not more than just parts of the East Coast. And so The influence was tremendous. What we just heard, That's My Desire, that song originated in the mid-40s as a Frankie Lane pop song, but the boys just got together on the corner and came up with that wonderful arrangement. The soaring falsetto is that of Angelo DeLeo of the Belmonts. He's the one guy that had absolute perfect pitch, which is both a blessing and a curse, because he never let the guys get away with anything that was less than perfect. And a lot of what made some of the, you know, memorable doo-wop so appealing was the fact that it had a little flaws in it. But on that particular record, they were just absolutely flawless in their doo-wop arrangement of it. And the other, and they were, you know, an Italian-American group. There were so many of the Italian-American groups that went along with the R&B groups. You know, we heard Earth Angel by the Penguins on the West Coast. They were a black group that did originally the blow harmonies that turned into the sweet doo-wop sound. But the groups in the Bronx, and I say a lot of them were Italian-American groups, they just love getting together to sing, and they just tightened the harmonies as best they could. Freddie Milano did the mid part. Dion, if that song had played a little longer, you would have heard his voice just dripping with emotion on the lead part. And then Carlo Mastrangelo, he was the one that did all the dips on on all the many other records they did. They were so great, but they broke up very quickly.
The vocals are what really gets me in those early groups. They were so dependent on that, like you say, perfect pitch, the timing, the dip, 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 stuff like that had to be so precise. And, you know, we got this email from Robert in Burlington who says, your show seems to straddle the sea change from the pre-Beatles and post-Beatles era. Do you think this is a fair distinction in popular music? I think he means, like, you know, is there music before the Beatles and then after the Beatles?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and you know, a lot of what I do is to look at someone's career in music, and that would either be a songwriter, a record producer, an arranger, names that you would not know. And if you look at, given that the rock and roll era, which was the original start of the original focus of what I was doing, began in the 1950s, and if I'm 80 years old now, and most of the people that were part of the rock and roll scene in the mid-1950s were maybe at least 10 years older than me, it's not surprising that we have lost many of them over the years. So I do a career retrospective. If someone passes on, I make it definitely a celebration of their life in music. But oftentimes, someone will start with music that was very early on in the 50s, but continue well into the 80s, into the new millennium as well. And you'd be surprised. I think that's what gives it pretty much of a longitudinal approach to popular music, because unless you knew that all these songs were connected by, let's say, arranger Perry Bodkin Jr. or songwriter Jerry Fuller, you'd be surprised to hear these songs all played together. You know, and many of the Beatles and British Invasion songs, Mitch, were covers of American records. Needles and Pins by the Searchers, a lot of the early Beatles, were cover records before they realized, hey, we could write our own.
Sure, and the Rolling Stones, of course, were borrowing from blues musicians in America and doing all of that sort of thing. Let's go to the phones. We've got Carl on the line from West Burke. Hi, Carl. You're on the air with Joel Nagemann.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hello.
I was wondering, Joel, if you, I love your show. I was wondering if you had any information about a song called Nothing Takes the Place of You by the artist Toussaint McCall.
Oh, yeah. I don't know the history of it. I've heard the song. It's all part of that big New Orleans scene that I've investigated over time. I've done a number of songs. I believe that song was recorded in Cosmo Matassa's studio down in New Orleans. Is there anything more you'd like to share, or am I missing the boat on that?
I think it's on RONN Records.
Yep, and, that's a New Orleans label.
Okay, and I wondered if it was if he was related to Toussaint McCall, if that was like a stage name he used for that song, or
Toussaint McCall. I was assuming they were the same. No?
I Excuse me, Alan Toussaint.
Alan Toussaint. That's
Alan
what
Toussaint.
I was wondering
okay,
too.
Yeah. No, they would be. They would be different. But Toussaint or Toussaint, very common name down there. A number of relatives of Alan Toussaint are performing. Very much like many of the New Orleans artists.
Carl, thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. If you'd like to speak with Joel Najman, our phone lines are open. It's 800-639-2211. I want to get back to playing a little bit more music here, Joel. And, you know, one of the things we have asked about before is session musicians. And I know that one of your favorites is someone named Al Gorgoni. Am I saying that right?
Absolutely, yeah. He is... on Facebook, and I got to know him after having after doing a couple of programs on him and having some live interviews with him, and also meeting him through another songwriter. He's a session guitarist, but he started out with Chip Taylor, who was a songwriter who wrote Wild Thing. He wrote Angel of the Morning, or Shaggy's Angel, if you want to.
Very different sounding songs, those two.
Same songs. Checks went to the same songwriter, and they worked together. But they began. I first ran into him when they were a folk duo, Chip Taylor and Al Gorgoni, as a group called Just Us, and they did "You Can't Grow Peaches on a Cherry Tree." But then people started to I have to tell you a quick story. Chip Taylor had a show down in New York, and I was going down to it, and he said, "Well, why don't you sit with my niece? Do you like kids?" And I said, "Okay, I like kids." And so I went there, and I'm getting ready for the show, and a bunch of his relatives. It was a big anniversary, and Chip Taylor, people were sort of coming to where we were, but we were blocked off, and I thought, nobody's coming to see me. Nobody knows who the heck I am. Well, his niece was Angelina Jolie.
Oh, people know who she is.
I didn't recognize her. I wasn't even thinking. Yeah, but he is the brother of John Voight. So, and his other brother is a famous volcanologist, Barry Voight. So what a family. But anyway, Al Gorgoni was his guitarist for so many great songs. But when you think of this, I'll tell you a quick triple story on Al Gorgoni. Paul Simon and Art Garfunkel come out with a folk album Wednesday morning, 3 a.m.
Oh,
and on there is a song. And in the liner notes, Artie writes, I met when I was doing summer work at graduate school at Columbia University, and he was studying agriculture, or architecture, rather. And believe it or not, when I first met him, I still knew him as part of the rock act Tom and Jerry, which was the early incarnation of Simon.
Not to be confused with the cartoon, but yeah.
Yeah, right. Well, I'm sure they named themselves in that regard. But at any rate, a DJ down in Artie wrote on the liner notes, "Sound of Silence is a major work by Paul." You know, and but nobody knew that until a DJ down in Florida somewhere started playing it as a single.
Huh.
And but it's very acoustic.
Yeah.
It's just two guitars on that, and the people at Columbia were scrambling and saying, "This can be a single, but it needs drums, needs electric bass, needs a Fender bass, and it needs electric guitar." Called Al Gorgoni, and he and I think Huey McCracken, but Al do something with a guitar, and he put that electric guitar bit at the beginning of it, just divides it and put it on the beginning. You know, and as I look back at how the folk rock movement started, I credit Al Gorgoni in about, four or five seconds starting folk rock.
I mean, that is kind of amazing that the little things that can change the fortunes of a song turn it into a hit from what may have still just been an obscure single, as you were saying, with the acoustics. I apologize before I said Greg Gorgoni. It's Al Gorgoni.
Al Gorgoni.
Let's play a little bit of Summer Rain with the group The Cousins that he was a part of. Let's listen.
Okay, sure. Al eventually found himself being able to make more of an income being in New York City, staying in New York City, where his wife and family did not want him to be traveling with groups. So he worked. And now Van Morrison was signed by fellow named Bert Burns, who wrote Twisted Shout for our Twisted Shout party. Mm. Bert had a recording session for his record, Bang Records, and Van Morrison had just come out of his group, his band, Them, and was signed as a solo artist, which meant that they were going to bring studio musicians in. Anyway, the short version of this story is that Van Morrison was not really happy having all these studio musicians around him and background singers. We mentioned Sissy Houston. She was there for the Brown Eyed Girl session. And they asked Al Gorgoni, can you come up with something to put a little punch in this record? He devised on location that incredible guitar sound on Brown Eyed Girl.
Wow.
Okay.
And we just heard him before on that Summer Ring. Was that Al Gorgoni doing that little trill of the kind of, or was it, yeah?
Yeah, the plucking of the guitar that sounded like rain.
Yes, know? Yes. Oh, that was beautiful.
And I'll just tell you, I know we're at time, but one story reminds me of the other. Janis Ian, who wrote so many wonderful songs, folk music, she had written one that was very autobiographical and... Al Gorgoni was brought in as the guitarist, and he said, you know, this is kind of a jazz piece. Would you mind if I came up with... And she said, please. And if you listen to the wonderful recording of Janis Ian at 17, mm-hmm. that's Al Gorgoni's incredible guitar. And, you know, I started in my 70s. I finally bought an electric Fender guitar, and I'm trying to learn a little bit of some of these great riffs. it's unbelievable, the talent. So I admire him. And also, he's the nicest guy in the world. He would talk to you about any part of his career. He's actually recorded some classical guitar music lately, and in his retirement, one of the nicest people for me to know and still be in touch with.
Session players, just incredible. Yeah. Sometimes the unsung heroes.
Yes,
of
really.
I want to take a quick phone call here. Jackie is on the line from Brattleboro. Hi, Jackie.
Hi, Mitch. How are you?
I'm well. Thanks for calling in. You're on with Joel Nagemann.
I know. Hi, Joel.
Hello.
I am so thrilled. Two of my favorite voices from Vermont Public. I have been listening for a long time to you, Joel. And it's just wonderful to hear Mitch do with you, Joel, what you do with music. He's going over your picture.
Well,
I'm wondering. Go ahead.
Go ahead. No, you go ahead.
Oh, okay. So I had a question. Joel, do you get calls from the artists and their promoters, and do they give you this information? Do they say, hey, listen, you should hear this song, and this is the story that goes with this song? Or do you just have, like, relationships with these people? Or, I mean, how I often think, when I'm listening to the stories that you tell, that somebody called you up and told you that.
Well, it's usually I call them.
Oh, you call them first. You reach out first.
Yeah, you know, and I've developed many relationships and learned the stories behind the songs. Of course, I love doing research. If I were to be immodest about something, I am a good researcher, and I try to find the stories, and then I try to find whether every aspect is true or not, because there are a lot of legends and hyped up stories. But no, I have developed these relationships, and once people are comfortable with me, they'll tell me lots of stories. I'm doing a discography for a book on a songwriter, and I've spent like 2 years finding every aspect of the songs that he wrote. And I've discovered that in many cases, when I'm talking with the songwriter, they've forgotten songs that they wrote. I've been privy to only a handful of recording sessions, and I will never forget any aspect of any of that. But when you come right down to it, someone might, you know, tell me, hey, you did a show on, and I can't remember the show that I did, but it still amazes me that songwriters might not even having remembered written a song, and I'll play the recording of it, and they're amazed.
We're going to be back with more from Joel Nagemann in just a moment. Taking a short break, you're listening to Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Mitch Wertlieb in for Michaela Lefrak. We are speaking with Joel Nagemann today, the host of My Place. Just before we get back to Joel, I want to mention that on tomorrow's program, we'll be welcoming former Vermont Governor Madeline Cunin. She served three terms as the first and so far only woman governor in the state of Vermont, and she's also a poet. She's released her second collection of verse last year. It's called Walk With Me. And if you have any questions for Governor Kunin ahead of our conversation tomorrow, send them to vermontedition@vermontpublic.org, and we hope you'll join us tomorrow at noon. Joel, back with you now. This is a question I'm super curious about. How many records do you think you own?
Well, back when the only way to have the record was to have a record, was to actually own the piece of vinyl, I think I had about 20,000.
20,000.
Yeah.
And are you one of the aficionados of vinyl only, or did you embrace CDs when they came out? Oh. Those are old now, you know?
Well, I had a mobile DJ business, so I justified buying the 45s, the newer ones, to go with the older ones. But what I... what my pleasure is right now with regard to the history of music is getting an original copy of certain records on the original label. I actually will frame them and put them on the wall. Some of the, you know, we mentioned Earth Angel, to have it on the Duto label, to have some of my favorite, you know, Phil Spector productions on the Phyllis label, to have Dion and the Belmonts on the Laurie label, a label that I actually interacted with, worked with some of the principals at that company in the later years of that record company. And so I like seeing the original label. Obviously, for the music program, for my place, it's important just to have the music. And sometimes I'm actually able to find, you know, better versions of the music than my worn-out records by going online or, you know, buying a new CD. I still buy CDs.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you've embraced the new technology. You've had to over the years. I remember reading an interview with Neil Young, and this is around the time when vinyl started to make sort of a retro comeback, and he was saying that he felt like the drop of the needle on vinyl somehow made the music sound richer and warmer. I mean, do you think he has a point?
Absolutely. In fact, if you research further, Todd Rundgren made a point of that. Now, Todd Rundgren, an artist himself, but also a record producer and arranger and a mixer of music. He was recording analog. He still might be recording analog at times, but he was recording analog well into the digital era, pointing out the warmth and feel and ambiance of analog recording, because that's how we first learned the music. Just because digital is a more precise version doesn't make it sound better.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yep.
And I can hear the sharpness. It's fine to remaster from the original tapes, but if the final product is totally digitized, there's something missing. And there's a big market right now for vinyl records, not just the used ones in the record stores that people are buying, but brand new reissues of albums are coming out from the original master tapes in an analog format. One thing that always amazed me is that why hasn't somebody actually come up with a tone arm, you know, that will put out like a laser or something so the tone arm doesn't have to touch the record? Huh. I'm surprised that hasn't happened, or maybe it has. But the state-of-the-art analog situation these days is a high-quality turntable with a well-balanced tone arm and a high-grade vinyl record.
That's a brilliant idea. You heard it here first, if that actually ends up happening. Let's go to the phones. Martin is on the line, I believe, from Williston. Hi, Martin. You're on with Joel Nagemann.
Right. Thanks so much for taking my call, Mitch. This is a wonderful show. And, Joel, you really are a treasure. we arrived in Vermont around the time when your show started, so you've been our constant Saturday night, you know, companions ever since then. Hmm. And I'm about your age. Matter of fact, I am your age. And I grew up in Brooklyn as opposed to the Bronx. And, of course, in Brooklyn, a lot of that singing was happening instead of in the subways, was happening under the boardwalk.
Oh, yes.
In places like Brighton Beach. And a lot of other things happened under the boardwalk as well.
And the Great Drifter song, Under the Boardwalk. Sure.
Yeah, that's right. But I was curious, though, whether you attended any of the Alan Freed Brooklyn Paramount concerts.
Oh, absolutely. A bunch of them. You know, it's funny. I went I've gone to them. I've gone to the ones in Manhattan as well. An interesting thing was I went to see Little Anthony and the Imperials at a taping of the David Letterman show once. And as I was and I always walk from Grand Central Station all the way uptown, mainly so I could walk past the Brill Building in, you know, at Times Square, and across the street, 1617 Broadway, where Atlantic Records and all the little cubby holes where the songwriters Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil and Carole King and Jerry Goffin and you know, worked in those cubicles writing songs for teenagers in that magic building. When I bought my 45 RPM records, they all had the same address at the bottom, somewhere Broadway, somewhere Broadway. Mm-hmm. It was that concentrated Tin Pan Alley. But at any rate, I went to many of those shows, and as I walked past one of the movie theaters, I remember seeing Little Anthony and the Imperials there in 1959. As I walked to Letterman to see him, I think in 2017 or whatever it was.
Joel, one of my earliest memories here at Vermont Public, back then Vermont Public Radio, when I was the host of Morning Edition, was yep. coming in well before 5 a.m. You and I had never met before, and here was this man in. I thought I'd be the first one in, but there you were, recording, making your show. Do you still make the show between 1 and 4 in the morning?
Yes, I do. Yeah. I sometimes get there as early as 9 o'clock, 9 p.m., but other times, 11 or 12, it's nice to be there with a quiet ambiance. You know, I mean, the working conditions here are wonderful no matter what time of day, but it's just kind of nice. It's, you know, it's I'm at peace with the world. And I don't wander around a lot in the building because I don't know if you've noticed, but they have the light-sensitive, you know, the motion sure. detector. So if I walk into the main kitchen area, the lights all go on. So I can just kind of sneak into the studio so I don't light up the whole building.
You know
but
what you're
I,
doing.
But I do. I still do that, yeah. And but at any rate, it was. There's so many great memories, and I and Little Anthony that night was saying that they used to go down into the subway wells for two reasons. One, for the echo that we talked about, but that's the best way to meet the girls when they get out of school. they would come up that particular
strategic.
You're right.
I think we have time for one more phone call. I'd like to get in. Leonard is on the line, I believe, from Killington. Hi, Leonard.
Hi. How are you there?
We're doing well.
I wanted to give a little, hi, how are you? It's good to hear from you as well. I wanted to give a Philadelphia twist
sure.
to the discussion. I was a young man who used to go to the Uptown Theater on Broad Street, North Broad Street mm-hmm. in Philadelphia. And I was among the groups and individuals I saw there, of course, included the ones that we all remember as far as the Supremes, the Temptations, the Four Tops, and Martha and the Vandellas. But there were others, too. There were the Stylistics,
yes.
Harlemans. I had the distinction of attending Stevie Wonder's 16th birthday party.
Oh, how wonderful.
Uptown Theater. Yeah, it was incredible. The other people I just wanted to mention, they really have done to a degree in Philadelphia what you have done in this area. They've passed for sure, but I wanted to mention High Lit and
oh, yeah.
Jerry Blavitt.
Oh, yeah.
And
the Geeter with the Heater. Yeah.
Geeter with the Heater, right. I wanted to mention also an African American who was on WHAT-FM in Philadelphia for many years. His name was Eddie Castleberry.
Okay, Eddie Castleberry.
Eddie Castleberry, right. And there was a complete, I don't want to say mixture, there was a renaissance occurring there as well, where for a period of time it was clear that the different groups who comprise a big city like Philadelphia or New York could find common cause and common enjoyment in the value that they all placed on the music that was available.
Leonard, thank you very much for that call and those memories. I'm thinking when he saw Stevie Wonder, it must have been Little Stevie Wonder.
Little Stevie Wonder,
then, yeah.
Fingertips and all that. You know, but I do want to make the point that, you know, I think that more – I can credit the early rock and roll and the group harmonies and whatnot to the civil rights movement more than anything else. Nobody cared. Nobody cared whether someone was white, black, or whatever. There were the black groups, there were the white groups, but then suddenly there were the integrated groups. One of my favorite groups, the Impalas there. I ran all the way home. But also Johnny Maestro and the Crests. There you had in one group one of the best voices in all of doo-wop. Anybody who knows doo-wop listening knows Johnny Maestro, later with the Brooklyn Bridge. But there was a Puerto Rican, there was a black, there was a woman in the group, early group. She wasn't allowed to tour with the Crests because her parents did not want her to go out of town with these guys. But she was part of the group. And Johnny, I got to know Johnny. Johnny would say that everybody was brought together until they went down south, where at one point the black groups would perform on one side of the stage and the white groups would have to perform on the other side of the stage. Part of the audience would have to be on one side. He hated going down south. At one point in one venue, he had to be on one side of the stage and his own group members had to be on the other side of the stage.
Oh.
Okay. I'll tell you, I was a part of a seminar in New York going back years ago. And Brenda of the Exciters was there, and they were the opening act to the Beatles on their Southern tour. And this was the first time she told this story, and I've never seen it in print, so I'll just quickly go over. There was kind of the Exciters. One of the Exciters' mothers was the chaperone, and as this black female group, as this group was traveling with the Beatles, she was cooking up ribs and all kinds of wonderful, African-American cuisine delights. The Beatles were just loving it. But when they got to Atlanta, Georgia, there was like a pall cast over what was happening because they were told that no black groups are going to perform before the Beatles. Mm. Okay. The short version of the story is that, well, If the Exciters don't open the show, the Beatles aren't going to perform.
Right.
And the Exciters became the very first, and I think it's the domed stadium there, where the first African-American group to perform there. And just an example of how music was at the time in a critical time bringing people together. I think today it brings people together as well.
That's where I want to finish, Joel, because I really think that your show, My Place, brings folks together. It doesn't matter your political persuasion, mm-hmm. what you think. Music is a universal language, and I'm sure
Absolutely.
You feel that way in putting it together.
Yeah. And just one thing, the street corner harmonies, my buddies in the Bronx would say, well, we ain't got no instruments, so we have to sing at Acapulco.
Acapulco.
So to all the Acapulco singers in the Bronx, my blessings. You gave me a career.
Well, Joel Nagemann, thank you so much for bringing us My Place, as you have for 40 years and continue to do so. You hear it Saturday nights at 8 o'clock here on Vermont Public. And thank you so much for being on the program today.
Well,
really
it's my honor.
It.
Thank you.
That's it for today. As always, you can weigh in on our show or pitch us ideas by emailing vermontedition@vermontpublic.org. You can also find Vermont Public on Instagram. Today's show was directed by James Stewart. Our managing producer is John Ahrens. Andrea Lorien and Daniela Fierro are our producers. Rick Barrett was our call screener today. Our theme music is by Myra Flynn. I'm Mitch Wertlieb in for Mikhail Lefrak. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll catch up again soon.